Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From 1910 to 1919, New Orleans suffered at the hands of its very own Jack the Ripper-style killer. The story has been the subject of websites, short stories, novels, a graphic novel, and most recently the FX television series American Horror Story. But the full story of gruesome murders, sympathetic victims, accused innocence, public panic, the New Orleans Mafia, and a mysterious killer has never been written until now. The Axeman repeatedly broke into the homes of Italian grocers in the dead of night, leaving his victims in a pool of blood. Orlando Giordano, an innocent Italian grocer, and his teenage son Frank were wrongly accused of one of those murders. Corrupt officials convicted them with coerced testimony. Miriam C. Davis here expertly tells the story of the search for the Axeman and of the eventual exoneration of the innocent Giordanos. She proves that the person most widely suspected of being the Axeman was not the killer. She also shows what few have suspected, that the Axeman continued killing after leaving New Orleans in 1919. Only 30 years after Jack the Ripper stalked the streets of Whitechapel, the Axeman of New Orleans held an American city hostage. This book tells that story. The book we're featuring this evening is The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story by historian and author Miriam Davis. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Miriam C. Davis.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. A very, very, very interesting and fascinating book. Let's get right to this book. We have a lot to cover. You open this book in 1919, and New Orleans and the Mardi Gras and Carnival and a couple people, Charlie and Rosie Cortimiglia, As you do in the book, tell us a little bit about New Orleans and Mardi Gras in 1919. Tell us a little bit of the state of the city at that time. And as you do in the book, you open and set the stage. Tell us a little bit about Mardi Gras in New Orleans in 1919 and the Court de Miguelis.
Well, the war in Europe had just ended, and they had decided not to have an official Mardi Gras. A Mardi Gras in those days was a very big deal. Everybody dressed up. Even bigger deal than you have now, where today you have a lot of tourists, you have a lot of parades, but at that time, everybody would dress up and sort of participate in a way and have the old-fashioned Mardi Gras balls in a way you don't really have today. But what seems to have happened is that there were these spontaneous celebrations that had just broken out with people dressing up and music going up and down the streets. So it really was a very celebratory time. And it was only a few days after the end of Mardi Gras that you have the attack in Gretna at the Corte Miglia grocery. And Gretna is now part of Greater New Orleans. But at the time, it was right across, it was a separate little town, a little settlement, right across the river, right across from New Orleans.
Now, you talk about Charles and Rosie. Tell us what business they were in, because this is important to this story, who they were, where they originally come from historically, and just the business that they had set up. Tell us a little bit about the Italians and immigration and them settling in this area.
Well, there were a lot of Italians, mostly 80% of them Sicilians, who came into Louisiana through New Orleans in the late 19th and early 20th century. The plantation owners, the cotton plantation owners, the sugarcane planters, wanted really cheap labor, and they brought in the Sicilians because they worked really hard and they were very dependable laborers. And what the Sicilians wanted to do was to go into business for themselves. So what they tended to do was to work really hard to save every dime they had, and then as soon as they could, to go into some sort of business for themselves. They often started out as little small peddlers, and many of them ended up as little corner grocery store owners. Now, at the time, of course, there's no refrigeration, and people have to shop, or housewives have to shop sometimes twice a day. So on corner, there's a small little grocery, usually family-owned. And the Sicilians, the Italians, were in the process in the early 20th century of sort of taking over this business. This was become a little niche. So corner, a family-owned, where the family lived in the back of the grocery, family-owned Italian groceries were very common in New Orleans at the time. And so Charlie and Rosie are a typical Italian couple. He was born in Italy and so was an immigrant. She actually was born of immigrant parents in Louisiana, in one of the sugarcane parishes. He had been a laborer. They were in, I guess, Charlie was probably in his middle 20s. Rosie was about 21. They had a small child. He had worked as a laborer for many years until he'd saved the money to go into the grocery business. And again, they had just this very small, smaller than, you know, most of the quick stops that we go to these days, but a little, their own little grocery in Gretna that they were running.
Now, you talk about the attack itself. Let's get to that, because then quickly you retrack and say that the serial killer, and that's what, of course, they wasn't called that at that time at all and wasn't recognized as that, but you say the serial killer had started 9 years earlier. But let's go to just the attack before we, as you do, rewind back to 1910 and the beginning of this. So what is the attack characterized by?
Usually, well, in the case of the Corte Miglias, they were discovered in their bedroom, slumped across their bed with their daughter in between. They were both badly injured by the axe. Their daughter had been killed. She's a 2-year-old toddler, and they're discovered very early Sunday morning when a woman is trying to get into the grocery, you know, finds it very strange that it's not open as it normally would be. And so the neighbors discover them, and the Giordano family are their neighbors, and they're some of the first to arrive on the scene. And you know, the sheriff is sent for, doctors are sent for, the whole neighborhood seems to scramble into operation and to eventually transport the Cortomiglias, who are still alive, although they're badly injured, to the hospital in New Orleans as fast as possible.
Right, and this Charity Hospital, which figures centrally in this as well, as where they were taken to. Now you talk about that right away, that there is, the police are on the job, but of course these kinds of attacks, as you write, are very, very uncommon, and so they don't understand motive, and so the police immediately look into the two couples, and the Giordanos living next door, and what do they find, and what information do they find, and what do they then attribute this attack to?
Well, the Giordanos and the Cortomiglias had in previous months a business disagreement. They'd actually had to go to court over it. So even though the Giordanos are completely forthcoming and cooperative in the investigation, the police, the Sheriff Marrero, just sort of decides, I think, because he doesn't understand the idea of a serial killer, he decides that they must have done it simply because they're the most likely enemies that the Cortomiglias might have had. Now, in fact, they seem to have made up and have been on very good terms, that Frank Giordano particularly, who was 17 at the time, just adored the little toddler, Mary, and she used to come over to their grocery and play all the time. But I think it was that the authorities in Gretna understood the idea of a Sicilian vendetta. Sicilians, because they had a distrust of the government, tended to handle things what we might call extra legally through the vendetta. And when the first generation of immigrants come over, unfortunately, some of them bring that practice with them. And so it's not uncommon for there to be shootings or stabbings among the immigrant Italian community that nobody will cooperate with the police about. And this happens with the first generation immigrants. So the police in Gretna understand that. They're acquainted with that idea. But the idea of a serial killer is so uncommon and so unusual. And like you say, at the time there wasn't even the term, that I think that they just couldn't wrap their heads around it. Now, across the river, where there have been these series of attacks, the police superintendent, Frank Mooney, he doesn't use the term serial killer, but he's tumbled to the fact that there seems to be somebody who is serially attacking Italian grocers. But the trouble is that the Gretna authorities refuse to listen to the New Orleans authorities, and they just jump to the conclusion that the Giordanos must have been guilty because they were the most obvious suspects.
Now, this is the story of Frank Giordano and his father, and Frank Giordano is 17 years old, and as you write in the book, too, there's this relationship where he just loves this child and he plays with this child, and then through all of these circumstances, Rosie is questioned by the police, and again, the police are looking for a natural motive, something that makes sense to them, and of course, they have this idea that it's based on a rental dispute, and despite the closeness of the family, and despite everything, the Giordanos are accused. How does this happen? Tell us about the identification process that puts these two people as the accused.
Well, what seems to have happened is that while Charlie and Rosie were in Charity Hospital recovering, that the police basically seemed to have badgered them and said, you know, asked them very leading questions. And, you know, did the Georgianos do it? Did the Georgianos do it? Was Frank there, you know? And, in fact, none of the doctors ever heard either one of them accuse anybody. Rosie's doctor, up until when she left the hospital after 3 weeks, testified in court that she told him she had no memory of who attacked her. She had no memory of the attack whatsoever. But after several weeks of this badgering, the police claim that both of them have identified the Georgianos. Nobody else claims to have heard this. In fact, there are reporters who then will, after this report came out that the police are claiming that they've identified the Georgianos, the police, there are several reporters who go and talk to them, and it's pretty clear that they have no idea who attacked them. And in fact, Charlie Cortimigli is in such bad shape that he will just agree to anything you ask him. So it seems to me that that this identification, that this claim on the part of the police in Gretna is at best as a result of the police asking them very leading questions to which they will automatically answer, you know, yes. And then Rosie, after 3 weeks, is actually well enough to be released. And she's taken from Charity Hospital directly to Gretna Jail. And she's kept in jail overnight. And she later said, and then it's at that point that she seems to indict her neighbors. And she later testified that it's because the sheriff and the jailer told her that basically they were going to keep her in there, ostensibly as a material witness, but they were going to keep her until she, you know, did what they wanted her to do, which was to identify her neighbors as the attacker.
Yeah, that's incredible. So we, again, like I mentioned, you go backwards in time and then come back to this incredible case and to the trial. Needless to say that, before we rewind back to August 13, 1910, and what you call the Cleaver and Harriet Crudy and that attack, that these two innocent men, his father, this sort of not sickly but certainly not a strong man, and then this strapping young boy, Giordano, who loved the baby next door, are accused of this atrocious attack and on the baby and then on the couple, and are consequently sentenced, Frank, to death and to the father for life. Let's rewind to August 13, 1910, and what you call the Cleaver and the attack of Harriet Crudy. Why do you go back?
Yeah.
And what was characterized by that attack? What were similarities or differences in that attack? Tell us about that.
Well, I think that this attack of August 13, 1910 is probably the first attack of the killer who comes to be known as the Axeman. I think this was his first sort of dabbling in this sort of thing. And I think there's a lot of evidence the police believed at the time that he actually started out as a burglar because he used some of the typical tools of burglars at the time. And in this case, he seems to have started by robbing the Crudy family. Harriet Crudy wakes up in the middle of the night. Her husband has been hit with a cleaver, and this man is waving the cleaver at her, demanding money. She gives him money. He leaves very leisurely. He walks to the house. He puts back on his boots that he'd taken off. And I think that this is... I suspect this is somebody who started out as a burglar, but for whatever reason ended up attacking somebody. Maybe the grocer woke up in the middle of the night and startled him, and he hit him because he was afraid he would start yelling for help. And I talked to a homicide detective and to a profiler, and what may have happened is this burglar discovers that when he hits somebody with this sharp implement, that he just likes it. He likes the sight of the blood. He likes the power. And so his sort of descent into serial killer may have begun almost accidentally. So I do think that the attack with a butcher's cleaver, probably the first in this series of attacks, because I asked a profiler, a retired profiler from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, how likely was it that somebody would attack the same demographic, the same time of night, with a sharp implement, you know, that there would be one attacker in 1910, 1911, and then another attacker in 1918 and 1919, and he said it was extremely unlikely. So I feel pretty confident in saying that the person who started off with a cleaver and then eventually moved to using an axe was probably the same person. Right. And I think I can come up with a good reason for that. After the cleaver attacked Harriet Crute, of course, the next month, another couple is attacked with a similar implement, and these are the Rossettis, and they are very, very badly injured. And it's not until, though, early the next summer that Joe Davy is actually killed. And what the attacker seems to be doing in these cases is he's stealing a butcher's cleaver with him. He's using it for the attack, and he's dropping it at the scene. Well, of course, that means that he's running a risk, by an additional risk by having to go and break into a butcher shop and steal a cleaver. If he uses everybody at the time has an axe, because everybody is using a wood-burning stove. So anytime he breaks into somebody's house, he knows there's going to be an axe lying around. He can use that, he can leave it at the scene, and then he can leave without carrying anything incriminating like a butcher's cleaver or like a bloody axe.
Right.
So,
right.
So yeah, the attacks start with the Crutes in, I think it's September of 1910. The next month, you have another Italian grocer immigrant couple, the Rossettis, who are not killed, but who are both very badly injured. And then a few months after that, I think it's June of 1910, you have Joe and Mary Davy, who were attacked. And she's slightly injured, but he is actually killed. He's the first actual fatality of the Axeman.
You talk about some of the characteristics of the crime itself that was interesting, is that the person gained entry into some of these places by removing a door panel and then getting in and being barefoot or at least shoeless. And the thing is that even though police were accustomed to seeing the motive as robbery and looking at it very simplistically, even to the police at that time, they could see that robbery, it looked like, was not the main purpose, because money was left behind, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. Prying off, I mean, of course, these doors would have been very big, heavy doors, and there were these big, by our standards, door panels that the axeman would often pry off to reach in his hand to slip the latch. Now, that was not his only means of entry. Sometimes he just climbed through an open window if there was one available. Sometimes he climbed through a kitchen window. But the prying off of the door panel is one that sort of becomes a kind of signature. Often he would steal, as he did in the Crute case, he'd steal small amounts of money, but he'd leave valuable jewelry behind. Sometimes he stole nothing. Oftentimes it would look through like he was throwing things around looking for something, but nothing valuable was taken. So the police pretty quickly concluded that burglary was not his major object, although sometimes small amounts were taken.
You talk about and introduce this Jim Reynolds, inspector of police, but you also talk about what his opinion was on these murders, what the police, their opinion was, and then the media's take on this, and then some of the important media members that really advanced this, and also, as we talk later, helped the case of the Giordanos later to when they were at trial. So tell us what Reynolds thinks and depicts this killer as, and other police and the media. What is all of their takes on who this is and who it could be?
Well, Jim Reynolds is the first New Orleans police superintendent who appears in the story. He sort of kept his cards close to the vest at first, because he's the one who's dealing with the Cruti, the Rossetto, and the Davy attacks. And so it's kind of hard to get at exactly what he thinks. Oh, it's pretty clear that he doesn't think these are ordinary attacks. In this first set of attacks, the press are making all kind of speculations. This is when you actually see, the attacker compared to Jack the Ripper, New Orleans' own Jack the Ripper. In the first set of attacks, there is a man named Flannery who is arrested. Jim Reynolds sort of assumes that whoever's doing this is not quite in his right mind, because this attacker is acting very oddly. In the case of the Cruti attack, he not only sort of nonchalantly walks down the street as if he didn't have a care in the world, but he also grabs the Cruti's bird on the way out and sits on the stoop and releases the bird. Reynolds sort of thinks this is a person who might be what they called at the time a drug fiend, somebody, and this was a time when you can get things like morphine at the drugstore, that this was somebody who was doing this to get drugs and who wasn't quite in his right mind. Well, there's a guy named John Flannery who is caught breaking into a grocery in the months thereafter. And he's got a history of burglary, he's got a history of attack, but he also seems to have been sort of mentally unbalanced and perhaps a drug user. He's charged with that first attack of the Cruti attack. However, he's arrested for it, but he's never actually charged, because by the time they come around to putting him on trial, you had these other attacks. And so it's pretty clear that he couldn't be the attacker, since the superintendent does sort of assume this is the same person committing all of these attacks. And the poor guy, I think, Flannery, ends up being sent to a mental institution. But Jim Reynolds does start out thinking that this is somebody who is not only a burglar, but has some sort of drug problem. And that's why poor Flannery gets arrested, because he seems to meet that profile.
When you talk about the murder of Joe Davy, then you also talk about the assassination of the Scambrias, and then later, right after that, a month after, is the DiMaggio murders. Again, tell us what's the characteristic of these murders, and you talk about the ensuing panic and the media response. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, Jim Reynolds had really been expecting another attack, because he didn't think that if the person was still out there, if it wasn't Flannery, he didn't think this person was going to stop. So when Joe Davy is attacked in June, it's not really such a surprise. And he really, they pull out all the stops, they question everybody they can think of, but they can't find anybody who seems to be a really appropriate person to charge with the Davy murder. And so Jim Reynolds almost certainly was expecting another attack, which never came. Now, I do talk about the Sciambra murder in 1912, and the reason I talk about that is because, I start out the book talking about the writer Robert Talent and his version of the Axeman story that he publishes in 1952 in his book Ready to Hang. Because most versions of the Axeman story that people are acquainted with are sort of Talent's version of it. So I use him as kind of a paradigm to sort of test to what extent his version is accurate. And he had mentioned the Scalambra murder, possible precursor to these attacks in 1918 and 1919. And so I wanted to examine the Scalambra murder and see how it fit in with these other attacks. And I concluded, I don't think that there was a killing of an Italian grocery-owning couple, young couple, Joanna and Tony Scalambra, in 1912. But I don't think it had anything to do with the Cleaver, the Axeman attacks. They were shot, and it was pretty clearly that the wife, Joanna, was shot by accident, that whoever was trying to kill her husband, Tony, shot him in the dead of night, you know, point blank, was really trying to kill him. This, I think, had nothing to do with the Axeman attacks. I think this was some sort of personal grudge, probably having to do with the grocery business. I'm sorry. I think I lost track. What did you ask?
Now, after I get started on this.
No, I'm sorry. I get started on this, and then I don't know when to stop.
That's okay. Fine. You talk about the important is the Maggio murders. And so tell us about those two murders.
Okay. The death of Joe Cleavy. After the death by the Cleaver of Joe Davey in 1911. Mm-hmm. The police superintendent fully expects another attack, which doesn't come. There is another attack, and my theory is that the Cleaver basically is arrested for some other crime and goes to prison for 6 years. There is another attack in December of 1917 on Italian grocers. This is the Andolina family. Again, and it's with a hatchet. And it's very, very similar to all the other attacks, but it's not fatal. And I think this is the reason more people haven't heard about it, is because nobody died. But the next spring in 1918, May of 1918, is one of the really most gruesome of these murders. This is the one that Robert Talent thought was the first Axeman murder. Joseph and Catherine Maggio, middle-aged Italian grocer couple. They're discovered in their bedroom early one morning. Joseph has been hit twice with his axe, fractured his skull, and he had his throat cut, probably with a razor. Catherine actually hadn't been hit with an axe at all. She had been slashed to death with a razor. And the position of her body led the police to conclude that she'd actually gotten up out of bed and gone around the bed to try to defend her husband, and that the killer had turned around and slashed her throat, and she'd kind of asphyxiated and strangled on her own blood. I mean, it was a very, very gruesome death, but she's the only woman who's killed by the Axeman. And I suspect that if she hadn't tried to defend her husband, she would have survived the attack like the other women did. And so this attack gets a lot of attention because it's so gruesome. And so this is why I think this was the first Axeman attack that the writer Robert Talent, writing 30 years to 40 years later, that he knew about.
What is the media's depiction? You talk about two different newspapers and different approaches from their editors. You talk about a paper called The States, and you also talk about another one. Hopefully I didn't mispronounce it, but it's The Times.
The Times Picayune, yes.
Yes.
Yes, The Times Picayune. The Times Picayune actually is still in existence. It's sort of the New Orleans newspaper. There was a young reporter named Jim Colton. And he very quickly became convinced that there was a single attacker behind all these attacks. There was a lot of debate. Okay, by this time, Jim Reynolds is dead. He has been, in a completely separate but weird story, he's been actually assassinated by one of his own men.
Yeah.
And the police superintendent by this time is Frank Mooney, who was a former, who's got no experience as a police officer at all, but as a railroad superintendent. But there's a lot of speculation as to, is this the mafia? Is this, these are just burglaries gone wrong? Is it the same attacker? And Jim Colton, who's this young crime reporter for the Times-Picayune, I think he becomes very convinced early on that there is a single attacker. And this plays a role much later on in what happens to Frank Giordano. So the newspapers are reflecting these various points of view of, you know, speculation is about what is behind these attacks. But I also think that Frank Mooney, the police superintendent, eventually himself comes to be persuaded that there is a single attacker, what is what they called at the time, a bloodthirsty fiend. And then there's just a month or so after the Maggio attacks, there's an attack on another couple that owns a grocery store. Do you want me to go on and talk about that?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. I didn't want to stop you if you had a question. Well, what happens is about a month later, there is a grocer named Louis Bessemer and the woman who's living with him named Harriet Lowe, which everybody had assumed was his wife but turns out not to be his wife. The press always referred to her very diplomatically as his housekeeper, but there was clearly, there was intimations that there was more to it than that. But anyway, June 26, 1918, they are found all bloodied, and Mrs. Lowe has clearly, she's found in her bed covered with blood. She's clearly been, you know, attacked with it, with their axe. But right from the beginning, Frank Mooney, the police superintendent, has reason to believe that these attacks are very different from the Cleaver Axeman attacks. Now, remember, this is a month after the Maggio attacks. It's very natural to see this as a similar attack. But the thing is there's evidence that Bessemer and Mrs. Lowe hadn't been attacked in bed like the other victims. The blood evidence that Mrs. Lowe had been attacked on a back porch and then dragged to her bed. Bessemer claimed that he had just woken up in his bedroom, in his bed, covered with blood. Now, the police didn't think that could be the case because there wasn't enough blood. If he had been attacked in bed, there would have just been more blood in his bedroom. And there wasn't enough, they didn't think. The other thing is, these other attacks, they occur between 1 and 3 in the morning, in the middle of the night, usually on a moonless night. The blood was so fresh when the Bessemer and Lowe were discovered that the attack, they were discovered about 7 o'clock in the morning by the bread delivery guy. The blood was so fresh that it indicated they were only attacked about maybe an hour or so earlier. That meant the attack occurred about 6 in the morning when the street would have started stirring and there would have been neighbors to see if anybody entered the premises or exited. And neighbors all testified that they saw nobody go into the grocery or come out. So, and there's also, unlike other attacks, there's no evidence of forced entry. So this leads the police superintendent to treat this from the beginning as very different from the Maggio attack of the month before. Now, the newspapers tend to lump them together. And in the future months, whenever they're talking about these series of attacks, the Bessemer and Lowe attack is lumped in with them. But the police had reason to believe from the very beginning that they're different from these other attacks. And the other thing is Mrs. Lowe changes her story several times about what's going on. So in the end, Louis Bessemer is actually arrested and charged. And Mrs. Lowe dies several months later in about September of her injuries, the injuries she got as a result of this attack. And so he is actually charged with her murder. And I think the police were right. I think this is a very different kind of attack. There's all sorts of differences between it and the other Axeman attacks that I think, in fact, even though Bessemer is acquitted, and I think legally there was probably reasonable doubt on the jury's part, I think, in fact, he is the most likely person to have killed Mrs. Lowe.
Yeah, it's a very interesting case is how the media portrays some of the things that his wife says about him, some of the mysterious stuff, and then they claim that he may be a spy, for a German spy. And so you have a very, very interesting exchange between the police and Bessemer, and he is not a very timid sort of suspect, and so he scoffs at sort of those notions. And very, very interesting, the media response at that time, what they take and their role in this story and continuing the sort of the myth. But at the same time, we will find out soon that media like Colton are very instrumental in helping some of these, this case, find its truth. You talk about and introduce a character named Andy Ojeda, too, speaking of the media from the States, from the newspaper of the States. Tell us a little bit about the state of the media and their response to all of these crimes and how they were portrayed in the newspapers.
Well, I will say Ojeda is one of the people who goes to interview the Cortomiglias after
right.
the police are claiming that the Cortomiglias are identifying their neighbors. And he's one of the ones who writes a story showing that this is just nonsense. So he is a crime reporter. He's very much interested in this. I'm trying to remember because it's been a long time since I've looked back at this section, but Ojeda is convinced that there is one attacker. I think that the Ojeda's newspaper might have been a little bit more skeptical of that, at least initially. But I know that different newspapers are reflecting some of the different opinions on the part of the police. Because while Frank Mooney is convinced that there is a single attacker, some of his police officers aren't all convinced. Some of them suggest maybe it's the mafia, although a lot of them just want to argue that they're just burglaries gone wrong.
I bring this up because there's a very, very interesting, again, it's just parallels with today and, again, the golden age of serial killers of 70s through to 2000. But you talk about a letter purported to be from the Axeman in the Times-Picayune, and it was with the heading Hell. Tell us the gist of what was said in this letter purported to be from the Axeman. And what was the response from media? Did they believe this? And what was the response from the public?
Oh, yeah. This is if people have heard of the Axeman of New Orleans, this is the part of the story they probably heard about. I mean, this is the version of the story you get in American Horror Story, the axe,
right.
The jazz-loving serial killer. Okay, about a week after the Cortomiglia attacks, the Times-Picayune publishes a letter which purports to be from the Axeman. And it is from hell. He claims to be a fell demon from the hottest hell. And he says that the next Tuesday night, the letter is published on a Sunday, the next Tuesday night, he will be roaming through New Orleans at midnight looking for victims. But he would spare any household that was listening to jazz. Now, I am virtually certain, and I talked to the profiler that I work with and the homicide detective, and they agree that almost certainly the real killer did not write this letter. The person who wrote this letter was very educated. He makes the classical allusion to Tartarus. It's very well written. From the identifications that we have of the attacker, he was a working class person who at that time would not have been well educated. So he's not likely to have written such a letter. I think, and you can't libel the dead, so I'm safe in saying this, I think the most likely suspect is a local songwriter named John Joseph Davila, who right after the letter came out and it got all this attention, he came out with a song called The Mysterious Axeman's Jazz, which was a big hit. So I remember when I think it was a homicide detective, when I was telling him about this, he goes, yep, he done it. He's the person who probably wrote this. So that's my theory about this. But almost certainly the actual killer did not write this letter. Of course, it does, obviously, it gets a lot of media attention, and it's one of the aspects of the story that has remained in the public consciousness.
You talk about that while this search for this Axeman, and throughout this book you talk about too that the black man at that time was just the person that they looked at first because of just supposed the black man's sense of criminality, their predilection for criminality was well known or well accepted, and so they instantly went to a black man. And you talk about a man named Mumfrey, and tell us a little bit about this idea that this black man was the Axeman.
Well, now Joseph Mumfrey wasn't black; he was actually Italian. They did in many cases, one of the first people that they arrested and questioned would often be a black man. But that's, first of all, New Orleans was there were a lot of black people there, and so both black and white people were questioned and then released. And in fact, while they were black people, black men questioned in almost all of these cases, there were, white men questioned as well. So I think, and of course, black people were poor then, and often you looked at poorer people to be burglars and this sort of thing. So I don't think it's, while, of course, it was a very racist, segregated time, I don't really think that's a good example. Although I do talk about how, yes, there was sort of this assumption of black criminality that I think led some people to suspect that this kind of strange murderer might be black. But in fact, the major suspect that people still talk about is an Italian immigrant named Joseph Mumfrey. And he was basically low-level thug. He had been sent to prison for bombing a grocer who wouldn't pay, kind of blackmail. He later, after all of these attacks are ended in New Orleans, he ends up in Los Angeles where he's murdered. Well, I won't say murdered, but he's shot and killed by the widow of the last person in New Orleans who Robert Talent claims is the last Axeman victim. It's Mike Pepitone is kind of an Italian immigrant. He's got sort of criminal connections. He is killed in the middle of the night. Now, if you read the police reports, it's pretty clear the police concluded very quickly that it was not an Axeman killing. There were two men at the scene at the crime scene. He was not hit with an axe, but still you've got the newspaper headlines, which all mention the Axeman. But when you read the stories, it's clear that the police think this is sort of an Italian crime related murder. Well, anyway, Mike Pepitone's widow ends up several years later in Los Angeles, married to a man named Angelo Albano, who had been in business with this thug who's now out of prison, Joseph Mumfrey. Apparently, her husband disappears, and Mumfrey shows up demanding money from her and says, yes, if you don't give me money, I'll do to you what you did to my husband. So she empties two revolvers into him, including three shots in his back as he's trying to get down the stairs. She pleads self-defense, and she is acquitted by a jury in Los Angeles. And is the reports of this the killing of Mumfrey and her trial, and the reports of this filter back to New Orleans, and it's at that point that you get the sort of scrambling of the story in which Mumfrey is reported to be the Axeman. You have this misreporting of the events in Los Angeles. And I think that's what leads to this legend that Joseph Mumfrey was the Axeman. I mean, the press play a central role in the story, not only in getting Frank Giordano eventually exonerated, but also in sort of creating this legend of the Axeman, which is not totally rooted in inaccuracy.
Yes, what you have is that you talk about Andy Ojeda's stories are a basis for Talent's Axeman tale, and then he claims that the axe murders are solved, and with blame for Crudy, Joseph Davey, Scambria, DiMaggio's, Andolina. So it was wrong. This Robert Talent, you take a fair amount of time explaining that this stuff is fictional. A lot of the stuff in his account and based on some of the newspaper reporting, but needless to say that he has the account wrong on many counts, as you say.
Yeah, I think Andy Ojeda is working on his memory, and of course he's a crime reporter. He deals with all kinds of cases all the time. By this time, by the time Mumfrey is killed, the case is several years old. I think he's doing it from memory, and he just misremembers. And I think that's how the story gets scrambled. And Talent, writing years later, while I know he consults some newspapers, I also think that he's relying a lot on oral tradition, because there would have been people still alive who were policemen at the time. So I think he's relying on oral as a historian. I never like to rely on oral tradition if I have written documents of what happened at the time, because people's memories are not really as reliable as we'd like them to be. And so I think that's what accounts for this version of Talent, which turns out not to be. Talent did the best he could with the resources he had, and I'm glad he wrote his story, because otherwise I don't think it would have survived. But it was interesting to sort of trace where the legend got a little bit scrambled.
Let's get to, because we don't have too much more time, but let's talk about the incredible case, the incredible trial of Frank Giordano and his father, Ira Delano, and how it came that their charges were eventually dismissed, and who were the characters involved in helping that occur. So tell us about the trial of the Giordanos.
Okay. Frank and his father, Orlando, are convicted. They're tried just in May, I think, just a few months after their arrest. They are convicted on not much more than Rosie's, what we know to be coerced testimony. And in fact, on the stand, her story doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Of course, she makes a very sympathetic victim. The defense attorney has to be very, very careful. But, I just don't think that her story makes much sense. But at that time, I think she's absolutely convinced, because everybody was telling her, who else could have done it. The judge does not allow any evidence to be brought forward that there is somebody else out still attacking people, so he doesn't allow an alternative theory of the crime. They're convicted, and 70-year-old Frank is sentenced to be hanged, and his father, who's like 68, 69, his sick father is sentenced to life in prison. But Jim Colton, who is convinced, you know, that there is one attacker out there and that Giordano's could not be it, he goes up to Frank as Frank is sort of standing there shocked after the verdict. And he says, I will do everything I can to help you, Frank. Something like, I don't know, 9 months later in February, Rosie walks into the offices of the Times-Picayune, where there just happens to be a notary public, and says, I wasn't telling the truth. I don't know who did it. The Giordanos are innocent. I think what happened in the aftermath of the trial, after their daughter's murder, Rosie and Charlie's marriage fell apart. And Rosie moved back to New Orleans and got a job and was supporting herself and was sick for a while, actually. But I think that Jim Colton tracked her down, you know, convinced her to come forward. And when she came forward, she said, you know, St. Joseph came to me in a dream and said, Rosie, you have to tell the truth. And I think her conscience was bothering her, because I think she realized once she got away from everybody in Gretna who's telling her, you know, they must have done it, because feelings against the Giordanos were running very high in Gretna. I think that allows her to sort of come to the realization that, you know, she had just been talked into being convinced that the Giordanos must have done it, that she right. really, she didn't have any memory of the attack. And in fact, this is in February, and I think it's the next month, the case had been appealed to the Louisiana State Supreme Court, because the prosecution had done several things that they shouldn't have done, including withholding potentially exculpatory evidence. So on several grounds, I mean, the State Supreme Court could not take her recanting of her testimony into account. They could only, you know, look at the legal grounds for reversing the verdict. But they did.
Right.
And it takes several months because the prosecution doesn't want to give up. And at one point they even accuse Rosie of that they threaten her with perjury charges. But in the end, the Giordanos do go free. And I think that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that Jim Colton probably had a lot to do with Rosie coming forward.
Right, absolutely.
So I think that the media, in all sorts of ways, plays a very important role as active participants in the creation of the Axeman legend.
Now, you talk about Colton being instrumental in overturning the charges against the Giordanos, and it's an incredible story that you say they go on. The Giordano, unfortunately, two months after Orlando's release, his daughter Lena dies in childbirth, and he died 4 years later. But Frank goes on to be a successful real estate guy and business guy, and remarries. And you talk about Supervisor Mooney was out of the office by the time the Giordanos were exonerated. And he left the police force regarded as a failure. And he's the guy that really thought that there was a fiend. He did not think this was a black hand. He didn't think this was robbery. He attributed this Axeman, before he knew he was a serial killer, he had that idea that this was that kind of person. Now, you talk about the media, and then you talk about the end of the Axeman in New Orleans. Tell us what you think, you believe, happened involving Gretna.
Okay, well, I do believe that there was a particular killer who's going around targeting Italian grocers. I think that his last attack in the New Orleans area is the Cortomigli attack. And I think he goes on to attack elsewhere in Louisiana. I've traced several other attacks. In December of 1920, there's an attack in Alexandria, Louisiana, on a couple named Sparrow, Joseph and Rosa Sparrow, who, again, they're Italian grocers, small corner grocery. They're attacked with an axe in the middle of the night. Joseph is killed, and their small toddler daughter is also killed. About a year later, in January of 1920, well, I'm sorry, several months later, in January 1921, in DeRidder, Louisiana, which is, you know, farther to the west, Giovanni Orlando, who is an Italian grocer, is attacked with his family, and he is killed in bed about 2 in the morning. And then in April of 1921, in Lake Charles, Louisiana, which is also out towards the west, a grocer named Frank Scalisi is killed in bed. So I do think that you have a series of attacks elsewhere in Louisiana that meet this M.O. Of the Axeman. So I think he left New Orleans, but he kept attacking and killing. For how much longer, I don't know. He just kind of disappears.
Now, given your research and investigation into this, do you think, how do you characterize this killer? Of course, it's discussed the Black Hand and the Sicilian mafioso that would prey on Italian grocers. And you talk about robbery not being the main motive whatsoever. As you do in the book, you speculate what type of criminal this was. Tell us who you think the Axeman of New Orleans was in terms of character.
Okay, well, this is just the best guess. We have eyewitness identification that indicates that he is a white man of a working class background. Now, at that time, of course, Louisiana and the rest of the South is rigidly segregated between black and white. But the Sicilians who come in are they're neither black nor white. Many of them are very dark skinned because they're from the South. They're clearly not African American, but they're also not really considered white at first either. They're what we call sort of liminal, sort of borderline. But yet they're a rising social class. They come in as illiterate laborers, and they very quickly establish this sort of foothold for themselves. And many of them, you know, are rising socially. Many of them, a handful of them, become quite wealthy and prominent in New Orleans society. Many of them quickly become sort of middle class. I have my suspicion and my hunch, and it's only a hunch, is that this is a white male who feels like he's a failure, that he is not getting what he as a white man is entitled to, that has some reason for resenting these Italians who are outstripping him socially. Possibly, I mean, he's a burglar. We have reason to believe that. Maybe is that the homicide detective suggested to me, maybe an Italian grocer testified against him and sent him to prison. We don't know. Maybe his family lost a grocery store to the competition from Italians. You know, there are all kinds of reasons, but my suspicion is that it's rooted in the kind of social terms at the time, that the Italians were not considered quite white, but they're doing better than a lot of working class white people.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element of racial resentment here.
You talked about too that we just did not mention this, but the incredible panic, especially among the Italian grocers, but also among the community itself in New Orleans, when especially the media played up that this fiendish, bloodthirsty killer was on the run, was on the loose, the Axeman in New Orleans. So what we didn't talk about is, and you do discuss in the book to a great extent, is the panic that ensued because of this story and because of these murders.
Yeah, especially after the Romano killing, and I think it's, and I should point out that there are several attacks that there's some talk about them related to the Axeman, although I don't actually think they were Axeman attacks, but they contribute to the sense of panic. And after the Romano killing, I think it's in October of 1918, there really is a sense of panic because it's pretty clear that you have somebody going out there killing people. And particularly among Italian immigrants, obviously, there's this sense of panic. And you have stories of fathers who are staying up all night with shotguns to guard their family, and of families that are banding together, you know, so some of them can stay up. But there really was this sense of panic, particularly, obviously, among the people who think they're the targets of this attacker. This real sense of fear.
Yes, it's a very fascinating tale, and also too of all of the suspects that were rounded up. You talked about the mentally ill person that was languishing in jail while the attacks were continuing, so they knew that person wasn't, and so all of the people that they thought might be responsible ended up that weren't, and so it just contributed to this panic. And the police, again, a division between the police, where one police officer thinks it's one thing and part of the other police force doesn't. So the same kinds of things that go on in modern investigations, sort of not a unified response necessarily, and disagreements over who the killer is and people responsible for it. So I want to thank you very much, Miriam, for coming on and talking about the Axeman in New Orleans, the true story. For those that might want to, do you have a website or a Facebook page for this? How might people find out more information about this? Tell us.
Go to www.axemanofneworleans.com. And there's also a Facebook page, the Axeman of New Orleans, the true story.
I want to thank you very much, Miriam. It's been fascinating. The Axeman of New Orleans, the true story. Thank you very much. You have a great evening. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Good night.